This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and I'm here with my co-host, Celeste Carey.
Good morning, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 if you are in Points East. It would be Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7, and in the ether on the web, KBOO.FM.
Today is Monday, April 19th, 2010. Today is the 15th anniversary of the Oklahoma bombing and the recent and the beginning of the nation's awareness of domestic terrorism. However, this morning we will not focus on domestic terrorism, but we will focus more on international issue and how all these issues are related towards one another. Joining us this morning is Stephen Fake, who, with Kevin Funk, is the author of Scrabble for Africa, Darfur Intervention, and the USA. Mr. Fake grew up in eastern Pennsylvania and graduated from the University of Pittsburgh, where he was involved in student activism. He became interested in radical politics after seeing Good Will Hunting, where he first heard of Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. Like so many others, his political outlook has been heavily influenced by these two individuals. He lives and worked in Boston. We welcome Mr. Fake, who will help us to uncover and learn more about the situation in Darfur and bring clarity to what is often so much confusion. Thank you, Mr. Fake, for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Very good to be with you.
So to start out, tell us how you got personally activated, involved in the whole scramble for Africa and Darfur. Yes, I understand Good Will Hunting sparked the imagination, but Darfur in and of itself, if you weren't really steeped in what was going on with African politics, could slide right by you.
Well, that was a bit of a leap. I had been following the news like many people over the years, and in the around 2004 or so, the Darfur became newsworthy. It got a fair amount of attention in the Western press, particularly for a humanitarian disaster. So wasn't on the front pages every day, but it did get a fair amount of coverage as these things go. And so I was following it like everyone else, and after 2 or 3 years, I became more and more aware that most of the coverage was very shallow in nature. There was an activist community that sprung up around it, which was quite interesting to watch, but it approached it from what I felt was a rather inadequate political perspective, and so I was simply interested in getting to the root of the conflict and what, if anything, citizens in the U.S. and our government could do to improve the situation.
Well, given the fact that the press coverage that we enjoy here in the States is generally inadequate and shallow, what was it that you found missing in what you were reading, what was available to us?
Well, you know, the coverage of the conflict tended to be very almost apolitical. It presented the basic statistics of the humanitarian situation and gave a very thumbnail sketch of who was responsible for the crimes, the central government of Sudan. But it didn't really get into any details so that you could feel like you understood why it was happening. And then perhaps more strikingly from my perspective, the activist organizations that sprung up and gained quite a bit of traction and a lot of prominence in the media, the sorts of demands that they were making of the U.S. government or of other governments struck me as, I was suspicious, so I wanted to, they struck me as inadequate, so I felt the need to look deeper.
We want to explore more about that because I thought that was one of the most insightful thing in your books as you examined the activism that rose up around Darfur and the critique that you and your co-author offers. But I thought we might begin by a primer, if you will, in terms of helping us to uncover much of the information about Sudan and Darfur. Briefly, and I'm sure you're well qualified to do this, could you give the our audience a little background in terms of Darfur and Sudan? Where is it situated? Its most recent history as in terms of the conflicts, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Well, Darfur is the westernmost region of Sudan, which is in the northeast of Africa, very strategically located. It's surrounded by a whole number of countries. And the region, you know, no one had really heard of it outside of specialists and people who lived in the region until about 2003. What happened then was a rebel movement that had just been in existence for a year or two made some bold attacks upon some military and police outposts in Darfur, and the U.S. Sudanese government in Khartoum, in the center of the country, responded, and that provoking a humanitarian crisis. And that was when the media coverage really started to pick up from the rest of the world. And the way the central government in Khartoum responded was to attempt to sort of a classic counterinsurgency technique. So they wanted to drive out the population that was supportive of the rebels. So they did this by, rather than simply relying upon the army, they enlisted whoever they could get on board in among the tribes in Darfur. They would give them weapons, and then they would say, you know, you can keep what you take from villages, just sack a village and you can keep the loot, basically, rather than sort of a standard payment or something. And so that was how the paramilitaries that became known as the Janjaweed were formed. And that method of counterinsurgency, you know, counterinsurgencies are always brutal, and predictably this was a very, very ugly result. So some perhaps 300,000 people have been killed, ultimately, and 2.5 million people have been driven from their homes. So it was pretty ugly. It was one of the worst humanitarian situations in the past decade, although certainly not alone or distinctive, unfortunately.
And in this humanitarian crisis, it began to get the attention of the world beyond its border. And much of it, I think it was misinformation, or perhaps it was because people were unfamiliar with the region in and of itself. Well, we're hoping that you can help demystify the situation by clarifying some of the things that many of us heard that may not be completely accurate. Among those, when you talk about the humanitarian crisis and the hundreds of thousands who lost their homes, sometimes there was a push for the Bush administration to label what was happening in Sudan as genocide, and the President Bush said that word in reference to that situation. Is that an accurate way to term what was happening in Sudan at that point in time?
Well, you know, a lot of legal scholars do disagree that it was in fact a genocide. It to some extent hinges upon rather narrow academic considerations, but we argue in the book that it, by most standards of the definition, it's probably not genocide. Partly because, although there were a huge number of people driven out of their homes and, you know, many hundreds of thousands of people killed, as a percentage of the total population of the area, it was a rather low percentage, so something like 5% of the population of Darfur. And when you compare that with some other classical genocides, such as Rwanda or Armenia or Germany, the percentage, you know, in those cases, it's upwards of 50% of the population of the targeted population that's wiped out. When one argues that, it almost sounds dehumanizing to say, well,
to base it on numbers only, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't want to minimize what happened, but for that reason, for these technical considerations, it may well have not been genocide. But I think the thing that is really important to emphasize is that whatever definition of genocide you use, it has to be consistently applied. So if you want to call genocide Darfur, what's happening in Darfur, a genocide, well, that's fine, but don't do so for political reasons. Don't selectively apply the term just to conflicts that are for outside political considerations. You want to publicize this conflict, but ignore another conflict.
Well, that's a great point. And let me ask you to speak on something that's parallel to that. Now, in terms of the political perspective, genocide was something that was bandied about, and as you said, it was selectively applied as a characteristic of the conflict. Another characteristic of the conflict was the fact that this was either Arab versus African or Muslim versus Christian. And can you comment on that? Because that's how some of the nonprofit groups, how some of the humanitarian groups characterized the conflict.
Indeed, particularly in the early years when the media attention was most intense, there was a lot of misreportage or mischaracterization from activists calling it an Arab versus African conflict. Now, there are tribes or ethnic groups in Darfur, and some of them identify as African and some of them identify as Arab. So certainly within the region, they do see something of that dynamic, but it's very misleading to simply report it that way and leave it at that for an international audience because, you know, in the U.S., everyone in Darfur would be perceived as African. Everyone has dark skin. They don't look like Lebanese people, for instance. So, as elsewhere, the racial realities are very complicated, and they don't translate neatly to the U.S. So,
that down for American listeners, so they can read between the lines, what you will have are people who, to Americanize, look African but consider themselves Arab, and vice versa. And then, if I'm correct, you've got what is kind of loosely termed Afro-Arabs. Which, if I understand correctly, is most of what the Janjaweed were composed of.
That's true, and you know it's important to realize that although the Janjaweed, the paramilitaries, came from Arab tribes, only a very small percentage—we're talking single digits—of the Arab tribes participated and contributed to the Janjaweed, and that was something of receive very little attention. So many Arabs in Darfur feel very aggrieved. They feel that they've been demonized the world over and have suffered both from being ignored by aid groups and being a second-class citizens within the region, partly as a result. But, you know, I think there was a political reason that dichotomy was reported in the West as it was, as a African versus Arab, Arabs attacking African groups. And the reason is that it fits in very nicely with the war on terror, right?
So yes.
You can picture Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden or something as being the attacker. But that's simply not the reality of the situation.
Well, it made, as you said, it made the Arab even more demonized. And here they are attacking the aggrieved Africans who are already suffering, you know, from the remnants of colonialism. And so, you know, that's really going to ratchet up the world's sympathies here in either direction. And so it seemed really beneficial to the United States to get on board with this. And therein lies, I think, as you've pointed out, one of the major rubs is the fact that this mischaracterization benefited the U.S. and that it wasn't the humanitarian gesture that it was made out to be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And a related confusion that was sort of on the margins because it was so obvious, it wasn't as egregiously made or as frequently made, but the idea that there were Christians in Darfur simply isn't true. It's virtually entirely a Muslim population. So those people who consider themselves Africans are also Muslim. Almost everyone is Muslim in Darfur.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Stephen Fake, who is the co-author with Kevin Funk of the Scramble for Africa, Darfur Intervention and the USA. We invite you to participate in our interview and conversation with Mr. Fake. You may participate by emailing us at moretalkradio@gmail.com or the phone number, Celeste?
503-231-8187, and join in the conversation.
And continuing our conversation with Mr. Fake about Darfur and this Scramble for Africa, and I think this might be an appropriate point as we uncover what is happening in that place, to put it in the larger context in terms of the U.S. and the U.S. role and concern for the region. So when Mr. Bush termed what was happening as genocide and the thousands of, you know, faith organizations and student groups were organizing to save Darfur, perhaps there was something more that was going on than we might have initially thought. It was more than just concern for humanitarian effort, and the U.S. had a larger role or more specific role concerning the region?
Or an insidious role.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, in regards to the genocide declaration, the Bush administration, a Bush administration official, admitted to an interviewer that the declaration was made solely for domestic political considerations. Those were his words, to appeal to exactly that audience, that constituency domestically. And that is, there's been a long-standing constituency around Sudan issues, partly among the right-wing Christian churches and so on, that have been focused on the older conflict between the North and the South, in which there were some Christians in the South of Sudan, and that sort of carried over to the Darfur conflict. So that declaration really was not just an objective legal decision. And, you know, the rest of the world, no other country found it to be genocide, nor did the UN body that was
right.
formed to study the commission that was formed to study the question. The the activist movement that arose around Darfur was very interesting, and in some respects, it's quite inspiring. So I think I'm certainly not going to over-criticize high school students or college students that, wanted to do something good. I think that should be encouraged. However, the origins of it were rather interesting. It was formed initially with a large number of domestic Jewish tending towards Zionist groups that, and this was reported in the Jerusalem Post, an Israeli paper. So the Save Darfur coalition initially was heavily Jewish dominated, and there's sort of a natural suspicion that part of the reason that Darfur received attention from these groups was because of it was a mechanism of distracting from U.S. Israeli crimes, U.S. occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a way of highlighting a different humanitarian crisis in the world that, we're not responsible for. And so one of the most glaring representations of that odd constituency in the beginning was that one of the first major rallies that was held in D.C. did not have a single Darfuri or a single Muslim initially. So they had lots of actors, they had Christians, they had Jewish groups represented and speakers, but they did not have any speakers from Darfur or any Muslims, which was rather glaring. And they eventually rectified that after protest, but it indicated that there was something else underlying it besides just a sort of generalized concern for humanitarian situations around the world.
We have a couple of callers online as we continue in our conversation with Stephen Fake, co-author of The Scramble for Africa, Darfur Intervention and the USA. And we'll go to our caller. Good morning, caller.
Good morning, yes. I was most keenly aware of Darfur in relationship to the Congo, and I had been tracking the Congo in scattered news reports in the New York Times for several years, where it was basically back page. There were small articles. Mm-hmm. And the very first articles I read, the death count in the Congo was already in the millions. Mm-hmm. So the attention was not raised about the Congo until the toll had already gotten to levels far in excess of Darfur. As I understand it, many of the people in Darfur weren't specifically killed, but they died of essentially a lack of basic necessities because they were refugees and perished that way. But more importantly, something like a number equivalent to the Holocaust, we're talking about 6 million roughly, you might have a better figure, have died in the Congo at the very same time that all his focus was being placed on Darfur. Mm-hmm. The focus on Darfur did not look like a natural grassroots effort, as you pointed out. It was a very well-oiled, very well-funded machine that seemed to instantly arise. And the main voices speaking up about Darfur were the sorts of people that had very little conflict with American foreign policy in general, were people without really much of a record for speaking up about human rights issues in ways that were actually controversial in this country. This was Darfur, I guess I'm agreeing with you, seemed to be a very safe distraction, and more specifically, a distraction away from Congo, where you're talking about 20 times, 30 times more people dying, and that being totally eclipsed. And for many years, now apparently people like Nicholas Kristof and so on have discovered the Congo.
Yes. Thank you for your call.
Sure.
And you addressed some of these issues, Mr. Fake. Could you respond?
Well, the caller has it exactly right. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is directly to the south of Sudan, borders it, is the most glaring example by far of a humanitarian situation that's been ignored. It's, as the caller say, it's killed upwards of 5 million people. It's by far the most lethal conflict since World War II. Nothing else even comes close. And it's received very minimal coverage, very sporadic and very shallow. It doesn't really go into the reasons for the conflict at all. Now, that should tell us something. And in fact, when you look more closely at the causes of the conflict, it began in the late 90s, around 97. And it was, in fact, called Africa's Civil War, or Africa's World War, because there were a number of neighboring countries that were deeply implicated in it, most particularly Uganda and Rwanda. Well, both of those countries have been and were U.S. allies. And in fact, what they were interested in, so they invaded the Congo, and they were interested in, at least in part, in the resources. And Congo is one of the world's most naturally wealthy countries. And it hasn't seen any of the benefit of that for the last 150 years. But, you know, ever since Belgium was in there 100 years ago, it suffered for it. And so the causes of the conflict in Congo, which just are impossible to overstate, the depth of the crisis, the causes are, in fact, they implicate the United States, Washington's allies, and Western corporations benefit from the Civil War because it opened up the country to its resources, particularly minerals that are used in cell phones and electronics like PlayStations, and as well as gold and various other resources, timber and so on. And what exists now is a very weak state. So they'll negotiate with Western companies contracts that give Congo almost nothing. I mean, very little in the way of revenue or taxation. The country is essentially just being looted. And what we're now seeing is some attention that does surface on Congo, sometimes about the rape epidemic and so on. But you almost never see anything in the commercial press about the root causes, Rwanda and Uganda invading, and the real reasons for what's happened there, which should hardly surprise us.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Stephen Fake, who is the author of the Scrabble for Africa, Darfur Intervention, and the USA. Let me remind you that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Veteran environmentalist and writer Bill McKibben is live in studio to talk about climate change. At 10 is Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, local trumpet maker Dave Monet talks about winning a battle to prevent a cell phone tower from being built in his area. At 11 on Health Watch, the guest is herbalist and acupuncturist Warren Shear, author of Ancient Wisdom, Modern Kitchen. At 11:30, the guest is peace activist Peter Lumsdaine, who will talk about resisting robotic warfare and military drone facilities. And at 11:50, the guest is Joe Salatin, the sustainable lunatic farmer featured in a new film called Fresh. All of this here on KBOO FM. Right now, we're speaking, continue our conversation with Stephen Fake about Darfur and Africa.
And we have another caller online. Good morning. You're, okay, we got it. Okay, it's dropped. Okay. I want to get to some of the reasons why we're having both the confusion and as it's been kind of characterized in your book, the fakery, the smoke and mirrors, regarding the involvement of the United States and some of the humanitarian efforts in Darfur. What is it that the United States is looking for? There are some that says it's oil. It's no doubt that we have backed some of the most repressive political regimes in the area. But what is the jewel that we're after? What was the Bush administration after?
Well, you know, there may be some oil in Darfur specifically. There's been some prospecting and not really clear publicly if there's any significant amount. There's a fairly substantial amount of oil in southern Sudan, which is a large part of why there's simmering tensions between the north and the south of Sudan. And in fact, the U.S. is it's cultivating a strong ally with southern Sudan, which may well become the world's newest independent country next January. It's slated to have a referendum in which southerners will vote for independence, and almost everyone feels that they will vote for independence. So the big question is whether war will break out again when that happens. But the U.S. has been training the southern Sudanese military. It's been strongly supporting development of police force and so on. And also U.S. allies have been collaborating in that, Kenya, for instance. Now, specifically in relation to Darfur, I don't think it's not so much that the U.S., that Darfur has something that the U.S. wants, but rather that because it's a bloodbath, a horrendous humanitarian disaster that the U.S. is not directly responsible for, it simply makes sense to publicize it because, you know, it by implication, if you're denouncing it, then you look better, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you're committing some crime, it's very natural. It happens on the everyday mundane realities between people. If you're committing some crime, point to someone else's crime to distract attention. And in the case of Sudan and Darfur, the Sudanese government is most strongly allied with China. So it really has made a great deal of sense for the U.S. to publicize this because you have an Arab-identifying government committing the crimes, and they're diplomatically and militarily supported by China. So it really was an ideal publicity opportunity for the U.S.
Is this a continuation of a long, century-old process where major military and political nations use countries for their battlefields?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Is this a continuation in terms of, as you're speaking about Sudan, is this part of a continuing effort where major military or political organizations use smaller nations for their larger destinies, for their larger desires, rather than allow them to speak for themselves? So is this playing field for the U.S. and or other forces such as China?
China, right.
Well, I think there's no question that throughout Africa, China and the U.S. are sort of battling it out for influence. China is very eager to get some sort of foothold in an independent access to energy. And Africa is one of the places where not all of the energy resources are tied up, unlike the Middle East, which the U.S. has sort of on a lockdown. China is a growing country. They're very eager to get independent access to oil. Mm-hmm. And Sudan is one of their primary suppliers. So a lot of African countries have been caught in the middle between the U.S. and China. And I think in some cases they can use that to their advantage. They can negotiate a better agreement for an investment project, for instance. But it does pose very real dangers for these countries. And in the case of Sudan, what happens when the U.S. Speaks out very publicly about condemning crimes in Darfur, for instance, it can in fact have a negative consequence because it polarizes the situation in such a way that the government in Khartoum, headed by President Omar al-Bashir, he can appeal to people in a nationalistic sense as, we've got an imperial power criticizing us. It's an imperial plot. Nothing bad is happening in Darfur. So when the U.S. criticizes the Sudanese government, it has something between no consequence and negative consequence upon the political realities in Sudan itself.
Before we get to our next caller, I want you, perhaps, as you made your last comment, it occurred to me that oftentimes we have a knee-jerk reaction, either pro or against, depending on what the other side said. I was wondering if you could just briefly outline what should be a principal leftist approach to the situation in Sudan in terms of advocating or what should we advocate for?
Sure. I mean, that was one of the reasons I was very interested in researching this topic, because of the demands or asks coming out of the Save Darfur Coalition and other groups were so inadequate and so ineffective. What I think needs to be emphasized is that, although, for instance, despite all the rhetoric coming out of Washington, aid and funding for instance, the peacekeepers on the ground there, or the humanitarian operations have been inadequate. I mean, they've really been on starvation levels. Particularly the peacekeepers have been very ineffective, in part because they simply haven't had the necessary equipment. It's been an ongoing situation since 2004. And, for instance, they need transport helicopters to get their troops around the region, which is quite large. It's about the size of Spain, just Darfur itself. And they haven't had any, so they've been asking for helicopters to get around for 3 or 4 years now. And no one in the world was willing, none of these developed countries were willing to provide any helicopters. So finally, in February, just this past month, the Ethiopia donated 5 helicopters, which is about maybe 25% of what they need or what they were calling for. And, you know, these are very basic requests. I mean, an NGO alliance did a study and found that there were hundreds of helicopters in the developed world that could have been used for these purposes, and they simply weren't donating them. So that really gives the lie to the hollow rhetoric coming out of Washington and other Western nations proclaiming their anger about what was happening in Darfur. There are other things that one of the most important other demands that I think activists need to make upon Washington that really should be organized around is ending any intelligence ties that the U.S. has with Khartoum. Mm-hmm. So although they are officially enemy states and they do have a very complicated relationship for years under the Bush administration, and as far as we know under the Obama administration, although it's I haven't seen any public information about it. The CIA has been meeting regularly with Sudanese intelligence agencies, who, by the way, are deeply implicated in coordinating the crimes in Darfur, and they've been collaborating principally for Sudanese assistance in spying on rebel movements in Iraq. So they're in Iraq. You know, assisting with the occupation. So these are relationships with individuals that are, in one case, the head of the Sudanese intelligence has been called the architect of the genocide by one commentator. And I mean, the CIA was meeting regularly with this man. So that needs to be ended, and that's a very basic, simple thing that Washington could do. And just one last point that I'll mention is that the Sudan has been pursued by the International Criminal Court. So the president, yes. Bashir, he's been, a warrant has been put out for his arrest by the International Criminal Court for the crimes in Darfur. Well, and Washington for years has been opposed to the International Criminal Court's existence, mm-hmm. just to join. But they made an exception for Darfur after a little bit of waffling. They decided, okay, you know, we'll support the ICC on Darfur, but just Darfur. And that quite obviously, I mean, the rest of the world can see the hypocrisy of this, right?
So, well, it's actually very confusing because initially when the U.S. was calling the conflict a genocide, the U.N. said no, it wasn't. And then even the U.N. has kind of had a shift itself. And so I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, not only is this confusing, okay, you're right, it does sound like hypocrisy.
Well, the U.N. itself has not changed its position, but the International Criminal Court, the chief prosecutor, has been pushing for a genocide aspect to the warrant for Bashir. So right now there's a warrant out simply for crimes, war crimes, and so on.
But not genocide.
And crimes against humanity. And yeah, and that was rejected initially by the court body that deliberates on the submissions from the prosecutor. The prosecutor appealed for that. My personal feeling is that the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, unfortunately, has not done a very good job. He's been very biased in his selection of cases to pursue. He's been careful to avoid angering major powers, particularly, most notably, the U.S. thus far. So, for instance, all the cases that have been brought against individuals have been in Africa, and glaringly absent from the cases that he's pursued even within Africa have been government figures in Rwanda or Uganda, again, the U.S. allies. He's pursued mostly weaker, low-level figures. Bashir is allied with China, but that's about as daring as he's been. But, you know, again, if activists around Darfur want to support international justice in Darfur and the efforts of the court, one of the best things for Washington to do would be to submit itself to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, because that would provide much-needed legitimacy. Lots of people in the Arab and African world are saying, you know, look, if the U.S. isn't going to submit itself to the rule of law, why should we?
Bashir? Why should anybody? Right.
Right.
Let's not hold our breath. But we're speaking with Stephen Fake, the author of The Scramble for Africa, Darfur Intervention and the USA. We have a couple of callers, and we'll go to our next caller. Jim, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm listening to KBOO for a long time, and the general atmosphere is that America is damned if they don't do anything internationally, and America is damned if they do something internationally. And you listen to the liberal side, and they feel like America has no business pushing itself in other people's countries, and the conservative side say that America ought to pull out all over the place, you know, just pull out. Mm-hmm. So I have one comment. I want your guest to just comment on this one statement. I'll make it, and then I'll take his answer off the air, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Is it okay? Okay. Here's a statement. America ought to pull out all over the world and simply let all the local issues settle themselves, let the U.N. settle those issues their way. I'll take the comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, you know, I think that would be an improvement. I'm not an isolationist necessarily, but I do think when you have an imperial power, it would be a big improvement if it simply pulled out. Ideally, we can say, you know, if there was a much more vibrant democracy in the U.S. that could really control foreign policy in a manner that was supported by the general population, a more ethical sort of foreign policy, then it would be good to positively intervene in the world in different ways. I'm not necessarily talking militarily, but you know, the U.S. government is not it's not a humanitarian organization. Generally, governments are not humanitarian organizations. When they intervene in the world, they don't do so out of concern for stopping war crimes or stopping genocide. They'll intervene for their own reasons, and then they'll publicly say it's because, well, actually, we wanted to stop this terrible crime. And, you know, all the while, they may actually be worsening the crime, but the media effectively cover for them so that there's a very effective propaganda system to support so-called humanitarian intervention.
And we'll go to our next caller. George, good morning.
Morning. I heard your reference that we're using some Sudanese assets in Iraq. A couple of years ago, I think, was The Economist magazine had a rather, maybe a third of a page on a very large Central Intelligence Agency building and facility in Khartoum. Apparently a couple hundred million bucks, which I've never heard anything since. Does this thing still exist? Do we still use Khartoum as a base for the CIA, have a big agency or a big facility there?
Thank you, George.
Yes.
Well, you know, I saw a similar report, and unfortunately, I don't have much to add beyond your caller. I saw one report on something of that nature and nothing since then. So it could well be that it simply hasn't been reported. Unfortunately, as you pointed out, the press corps in abroad generally, foreign policy issues and global affairs is very weak, and I think particularly in Africa, historically, it's been very weak, and there simply isn't enough investigative journalism going on. So I don't know if that is a reality or not.
We're speaking with Stephen Fake, author of the Scrabble for Africa, Darfur Intervention and the USA. A few minutes ago, you talked about the International Criminal Court and Western, the U.S. particular, either ability to ally or be responsible or to abide by what the International Criminal Court or choose not to, as the case is often. Another thing I thought we might want to talk about, speaking about democracy, which has been reported a bit, but I thought you might uncover, help us to learn more about the recent election in Sudan this past week. What happened and what's the situation now?
Sure. Well, the election was mandated by the peace agreement that was reached in 2005 between the north and the south of Sudan. It was a step on the process for the referendum that I mentioned earlier that will occur next year, in which southern Sudanese will vote to, you know, declare independence as a new nation. And so one of the things that was mandated is that this election happen. And there have been a lot of what are called sort of euphemistically irregularities, both in the preparation for the election and in the actual balloting, both in the north and the south. The southern Sudanese government and the northern government were implicated in various, you know, shady operations. It should be said that there is a fair amount of popularity for the President Bashir, despite the crimes that he's responsible for in Darfur. Partly because of the oil boom that's happened in the country. So over the last 10 years, as oil has really been pumping out of southern Sudan onto the international market, the capital of Khartoum has really developed. And, you know, you can see it. It looks quite a bit different than it did just a few years ago. There's lots of fancy hotels and new buildings and new construction happening all over the place. So there's some popularity for that reason, at least in areas that have seen some development. But there have been a number of problems with the election. The Carter Center was there and declared that it did not meet full international standards. The EU issued a similar declaration saying it did not meet international standards of free and fair elections. And Sudanese opposition groups in the country were very critical. The opposition parties, many of them, withdrew before the actual election. It does look like Bashir will win pretty handily, whether legitimately or not. Now, some commentators are saying that at least it's a step in the right direction. Sudan has not had a multi-party election for 24 years. It was in the 80s when they last had one, and the current government came to power in a coup. You know, it may be progress, but what I think really dictates whether it's progress is the impact in the country on the political forces. So if the opposition parties can gain strength from this, if the country's political atmosphere opens up, then that will be progress. But the election itself is simply, it's not particularly significant in and of itself. It doesn't represent democracy by itself. One of the things I think has been striking, though, is that in talking about double standards, nearby in Ethiopia, they're having an election next month in May, and the climate there is, if anything, worse. It's pretty ugly. Opposition figures have been imprisoned, harassed, and it's a very very difficult climate. And you know, that's really a dictatorship in Ethiopia, but that's a U.S. ally, and it's received very little media attention.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned was the fact that there were some of the rebel groups who were basically pushing for people not to accept the new government, the National Congress Party, and not to participate in it. But how much steam do you actually think that, for example, the Sudan Liberation Movement, SLM, can muster, given the fact that the leader is exiled, and that, I guess, they're diffused to the point where they may not really actually have any relevancy?
Well, you know, the faction of the Sudan Liberation Movement, the Darfur rebel group that does retain popularity, that is led by Abdel Wahid Mohamed El Nour, who's in Paris.
Yeah, he's an exile in Paris. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, they do retain popularity, particularly in the camps for the displaced that have sprung up in different areas of Darfur. So the victims of the violence in Darfur, reportedly, that faction of the rebel movement retains a fair amount of popularity. But they're really not, they're pretty divorced from the popular struggle. They're quite isolated from the population itself, so that, you know, the various rebel factions, they've split many times over since the rebellion began in the early 2002-2003.
Yeah, in 2006 they split, and you had some to sign the peace agreement and some that didn't.
Exactly, and that was a disastrous peace agreement. It worsened the situation. That was something that the Bush administration had been involved in pretty heavily. Now, I think within Darfur, you know, the rebel group does retain some support. Certainly, I think there's widespread hostility towards the central government, as is quite natural. And I think many Darfuris do feel that the election should have been boycotted. And reportedly in the displaced camps, although theoretically there were ballots and elections could be held, reportedly turnout was quite low.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of Darfur, I think the media is quite tightly controlled, so I think there's pretty limited understanding of exactly what's happening in Darfur and not a great deal of empathy.
We are approaching the end of our hour and time for our conversation with you, Mr. Fake, but I was wondering, as we approach a close, in addition to your book, what are some resources where people can find accurate information and alternative to mainstream groups?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there are a number of good activist groups on Africa issues in particular. Friends of the Congo, for instance, and as their name indicates, they're particularly focused on Congo, is an excellent group. And you can Google them. The Africa Faith and Justice Network, Africa Action, puts out, it's a long-standing, it's been around since, I believe, the 50s, think tank or NGO based in D.C. that focuses on Africa issues. And there's a new group that's came out of them called the Resist AFRICOM, which is focusing specifically upon activism against the new military command that the U.S. established 2 years ago, specifically to focus on Africa. That's something new. In the past, the U.S. has divided up the world into different sectors, determining how they have military commands. And for the first time the other year, in 2008, AFRICOM, a command focused solely on Africa, was established, which is quite worrying and indicates that further militarization of Africa from Washington is ahead.
We kind of figured that once we had Colin Powell basically promoting the whole issue with Darfur. But in terms of websites, we can also recommend, I know one of you has written for the Black Commentator, and then there's also allafrica.com as a news source.
Yeah, and I do link to a number of the groups that I mentioned, as well as further resources on the website that we established, scrambleforafrica.org. So there are a number of both news and news sources on the conflict in Africa, as well as the advocacy groups that I mentioned. Black Commentator is indeed an excellent resource.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We thank you for your advocacy, and we're really grateful that sometimes people who are ordinary can do extraordinary things, and we thank you for your activism, and hope you continue to write and keep us informed.
It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
All right. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Stephen Fake, who is the co-author of The Scrabble for Africa, Darfur, and Intervention.
U.S. Intervention.
U.S. Intervention. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and be sure to stay tuned. We've got more news, information, and programming coming your way. And around town, you might want to check out an event here. There's a book selling, signing, and photo opportunity with Tuskegee Airmen Alexander Jefferson and Bill Holloman. Takes place April 21st, 2010, from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at the Talking Drum Bookstore, located at 446 Northeast Killingsworth. For more information, call 503-288-4106. In the meantime, coming up at 9 a.m. is the Old Mo Variety Hour here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.